I'm going to read to you from Psalm 6, a psalm written by David, King David. And he's actually talking about when he is in a depressed state. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath. Be merciful to me, Lord, for I am faint. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in anguish. How long, O Lord, how long? Turn, O Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. No one remembers you when he is dead. Who praises you from the grave? I am worn out from groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. All my enemies will be ashamed and dismayed. They will turn back in sudden disgrace. Depression is as old as the Bible. It is so prevalent in today's society that it's been called the common cold of psychological disorders. It creeps into the lives of many, regardless of age, sex, or social or economic status. Some say we are experiencing a blues epidemic in an age of anxiety. Some people accept medication for help. Others insist that taking pills indicates a lack of faith in God, who heals. How can we know what course of action to pursue? Dr. Grant Mullen, a Canadian doctor, advocates a more balanced and holistic approach. He explores the integration of three God-given paths of treatment, and they incorporate the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual. We're going to hear from three Christian speakers. We're going to hear from a doctor, a counsellor, and a prayer minister. And they're all going to share something of the way in which they go about treating depression. I hope you find this an informative time. I hope that you grow in your knowledge and understanding of depression. And I also hope that you gain an idea of how to care for those whom you love who are suffering from depression, whether that's a family member or a friend. The first person who's actually going to speak is Dr. Lynn Scholes. And Lynn has practiced for 18 years as a general practitioner and has been at her current practice in Endeavour Hills for 15 years. As a result, she's seen a wide range of people present with depression. Lynn also sees a number of people with postnatal depression. She's currently on the PANDA referral service for women who are experiencing postnatal depression. Can we clap and welcome you?
Thanks, Bev. It's good to be here. I'm here to talk about the body part of this whole depression thing, so I'm really going to give you, I've been told 10 minutes, so 10 minutes worth of facts, but I'm sure you'll have lots of questions. Now, I'll start by saying I don't specialise in mood disorders. I am a general practitioner. That means I deal with the whole spectrum and the whole range of humanity, but depression is one of the commonest things that I do see, because when people are ill, they often do become depressed as well. So I thought I'd start by giving you some figures. Depression is more common in women than men, so the figures tell us, but I don't believe that actually. They tell us that women get it twice as often as men, but I suspect women tell us more than men do. The commonest age group is the 25 to 44 year age group, but it covers the whole spectrum, and I think in Australia we're getting a lot of younger people with depression as well. Now, these figures relate to major depression. And when I talk about major depression, that's depression that requires medication. And major depression over the lifespan will affect 25% of women, or up to 25% of women. That's one in four. And up to 12% of men. But again, I think that figure will be much higher. And at any point in time, about 9% of women and 3% of men will be affected. It is a very common illness. The good news is that two-thirds can be expected to recover completely, and of the other third, some will partially recover and some will need ongoing treatment for the rest of their lives. But depression's also a very serious illness, because of those people that have one episode, 50 to 60% of them will get another one. If you get a second episode, then 70% will have a third. And if you have a third, then 90% will have a fourth. So the more times you have an episode or need treatment for something, the more likely it is that you are going to remain on treatment. And I'd just like to say that I've never seen anybody that's had it for 20 years. I'm not sure what he was talking about on the tape, but some people can have it for a long time. I think the most frightening thing about depression is the suicide rate, and the suicide rates in this country are quite high. And for people with major depression, 15% of those will die by suicide. That's a fairly sobering statistic. So I thought I'd ask you some questions, because who is at risk? Who do we look to? Who do we think, you know, who might get depression? So I want you to tell me, and I'm going to write it up on the... Well, actually, no, I'll get someone else to write. Bev, you can write. Who do you think might be at risk of getting depression? Anybody? But specifically, are there certain circumstances or things that may happen that you might think that person is more at risk of getting depression?
Adolescents.
Teenagers? Grief? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, significant life changes, yep. Abuse? Any particular... Well, any abuse, really. Yes. Yes, a birth, that's a significant life change. So, and also a hormonal change. So when you're talking about women, major hormonal events like menopause or having a child. Stress, yes. Particularly prolonged or chronic stress, stress that goes on and on. Illness, yes, major illness. Or injury, yes. About 25% of people who have a major illness, such as a stroke or a heart attack or diabetes or cancer, will end up getting depressed. Pain, yes, chronic pain. Trauma. And getting back to the pain, but in the event of pain, if someone has chronic pain, then it makes their pain worse. If they become depressed, then they see their pain as worse too, so it actually compounds the issue. Sorry, trauma, yep.
Farmers,
doctors, dentists. Dentists have one of the highest suicide rates, don't they? There's one important group that isn't up here yet. A perfectionist, yes. Certain personalities, yeah.
The elderly,
yes. Yes, abuse. Yes, that's another significant life-changing event. Yes, low self-esteem. Yes, prolonged time. So all the spectrum. So the one thing that isn't up here is carers. Those people caring for people with significant illness are also at risk of getting depression themselves. Maybe. So I'll just run through my list. Thank you, Bev. And see how many we got. This isn't comprehensive, but the major medical illness, as I said, 25% of people who have a major event will become depressed. Any sort of major life-changing event or job loss or prolonged stress. Conflicts, family or interpersonal, and that can be the abuse issue. Bereavement, and we expect people to be sad in times of bereavement, but if the sadness is prolonged, it can move on into depression. But it can also be a major life-changing event when you're bereaved. Any sort of substance abuse, so people who are dependent on alcohol or drugs. As Grant Mullen was talking about, it does run in families, this predisposition to depression, and certain personalities, like the perfectionism, are more likely to become depressed, and any chronic and prolonged stress. And I haven't got carers up there, but carers is one group of people you need to think about. So what does it look like? Can you recognise a person who might be depressed? And sometimes the answer is no. Some people hide it very, very well. But I've grouped the symptoms, and these overheads, Bev's photocopied all these off so you don't have to write it down, but I've grouped them into four categories of feelings, thoughts, behaviours and physical symptoms. So when someone's depressed, they start to feel that they can't cope. They have this sense of hopelessness or helplessness, so they can't actually do anything about it. They feel like they're in this state, but they can't actually do anything to change it. Of course, they're unhappy, but they also start to lose confidence in what they're doing. So things that they would have normally done easily, they start to dither about. They become tense and anxious, and anxiety and depression go hand in hand. So if somebody has an anxiety disorder, they're often quite depressed as well. But it's not just this sort of low mood type stuff. People can often become very irritable and angry and fearful as well. And they start to have lots of feelings of guilt and worthlessness. They don't think they're worth it. And feelings that they're not wanted. Now, you might not see any of this. As Dr. Mullins was talking about, their thoughts start to become disordered. And it's the thought disorder that starts to perpetuate the depression, because it's almost like you get yourself in a thinking spiral that you can't get yourself out of. So they have a lot of difficulty concentrating, so things they would do easily, they start to really dither about. They might start to think about suicide. They won't often tell you, but you specifically have to ask, but they often think about suicide. And they have real difficulty making decisions. And this is something that I talk about, the pastor aisle syndrome. Normally when you're well, you're going up and down the supermarket aisles and you need some pasta. You hit the pasta aisle, there's pasta this much. You just go, yep, pasta. When you're depressed, you get to the pasta aisle and there's like all these decisions to make, and it's like, well, will I get the round one? Will I get the long one? Will I get the expensive one? You can't do it. You just cannot. And some people have actually said, yes, I've stood there for 10 minutes trying to make a decision that I would usually make in 2 seconds. It's very hard to make the decisions. And they start to get forgetful as well. And in their behaviours, they start to not enjoy the things that they used to enjoy. The reaction times are slower. Sometimes they behave less responsibly, and this is people who might speed or drink more, go out and get drunk more than they used to, or do things that they wouldn't normally do. Some people will even neglect their appearance and often use drugs or alcohol to make themselves feel better, but in the end it doesn't. And physically, they can start to feel very tired. So things that they normally would be able to do, they start to tire very easily on. They'll have sleeping problems, which is most often waking early in the morning, but they may have trouble getting off to sleep, or they may wake a lot through the night. Eating, they may eat more and more, or they may eat less, so they may have weight gain or weight loss. And then they can complain about a whole lot of things, from headache to constipation to even indigestion. And the symptoms will often vary a lot through the day, but are often much worse in the morning. So they'll wake up very gloomy and things might improve a bit through the day. Now, I've got a list of treatment options, and this certainly isn't exhaustive, but it's sort of the things that we would work through. So just educating somebody and supporting them. And as people who might be supporting someone with depression, that part is really important for all of you. Exercise has been known to help depression as well. It actually increases your endorphin levels and can help to bring you out of a minor depressive illness. Counselling is so important. I'm not going to go into a lot about medication, except to say that he talked a lot about serotonin. There are other neurotransmitters involved in depression. Serotonin was the big breakthrough with depression, because that's when Prozac came out, and Prozac was the first SSRI that he's talking about. He's talking about that group of drugs. It was a boon because they're very low in side effects, they're very safe in overdose, and they work very effectively. But sometimes people need specialist support from psychiatrists. They may need to go to hospital, and still we use ECT. Now, that's very controversial too, but I thought I'd put it up there because it is still used for people who are very severely depressed and sick. So, what can you do to help someone like me when you come in? Well, the first thing is to tell me everything. Don't hold it back. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't read your mind. So if you're going into your GP, write it down. Be open and honest about what's really going on. Don't be embarrassed. We've heard it all before. Just tell us everything. And if medication is necessary, always discuss coming off it, because the biggest problem that we have with the medications now is they're so good, they're so low in side effects that people do feel better so quickly, they think they're fixed. They think they're fixed, they come off the medication, they slump back down into depression again. That would have to be one of the commonest problems. The other one is, and I was talking to Ruth about this, is that they go on the medication, they feel so good, they don't think they need to have counselling because I'm better now, I'm all fixed. But the medication does help to get you out of that negative spiral of thinking so that then you can actually start to do the real work that you need to do, because then your brain is functioning properly. And people often are reluctant to go on medication because they think it's addictive. Certainly not addictive. The medication we have now is very, very good. And you should always think about having counselling with depression as well, because it is a multifactorial problem. You didn't just suddenly become depressed, so the solution is also multifactorial. Now, I'll hand it back over to Bev. I don't think we're taking questions yet.
Thanks so much, Lynn. That's really informative. Ruth Walker is our counsellor. Ruth is a trained and experienced counsellor with 10 years of experience. She works part-time at Carinya Counselling Centre, which is down the road. It's affiliated with New Hope Baptist Church. For the remainder of the week, she actually works as a student counsellor, as a school counsellor. She was a teacher in her former role. So you can imagine Ruth has amazing versatility, I would say, to be able to work with adults, children, etc. Ruth's particular love and interest in Christian counselling is working with those who are depressed and to see them emotionally healed and set free. Please welcome Ruth.
Okay. According to Grant Mullen, I'm an emotional baggage handler. And that's about it too. Counselling. Again, it's an area that a lot of myths are around, and I want to talk to you about, first of all, how to choose a counsellor. Doctors are registered, counsellors are now self-registering, and we have standards that we expect people to come up to, because we don't think that tarot cards or something, you know, like that, is counselling. So when you're looking for a counsellor, your first question is, what are their qualifications? They should have an undergraduate degree, a postgraduate degree, and if they're a Christian counsellor, I've got some theology as well. And if we're in a counselling centre like Carinya or Village Well or one of the ones around here that are Christian, you are guaranteed that you're getting somebody that's on their way to registration. And we've still got to get it passed at government level. So that means that you're not diving in with someone who's not experienced and not trained and hasn't done all the right degrees and stuff. There will be a cost associated with seeing a counsellor, and that will depend on whether you see a counsellor in a counselling service, whether you see maybe a psychologist, because behavioural psychologists work in this area too and do a very good job. What happens at counselling? Well, I don't have a crystal ball either. And so the first thing is, what has brought you here? And we will sit and discuss what's brought you here. And I'll be looking for a number of things. I'm not quite as open as the doctor is. I know what I'm looking for. Very similar things. And then I'll say, okay, it looks like we've got a bit of a downer here. Yeah. A big downer? Yes. So the next thing I do is, after I've got a fair bit of story, I get out my first aid sheet. Now, first aid's a band-aid, and you've got it in your little pack there. If you want to pull out the green sheet, it's got green stripes. You picked it up on the way in? They might still be out there. Okay, well, I'm going to run through it, and if you haven't got one, collect one later, and I've got some more. First step is medication. I get about 50-50, people who've been to the doctor and come to me, or people that start with me and go to the doctor. Because medication is part of it, we have to get the body biochemistry right. I'm also willing to look at natural therapies, again prescribed. I've got a chiropractor, daughter who's a chiropractor, a daughter who's almost a naturopath, and they do amazing things with depression as well. But the doctors have it very well set out. Second thing I do is use something called Rescue Remedy. You go to the health food shop, it's a flower extract, and it takes away the excess emotion. It just calms it a bit until you can get to the doctor. Brilliant stuff. I use it on all my suicidal patients. I just say, look, just let me put a bit of this on your wrist for a minute. And it just, in half an hour, every 10 minutes, I have someone who's no longer suicidal and can talk to me. With adolescents, wonderful. The next step is, in that gap before they see me again and or see the doctor, I get them writing it down, because Grant says it goes round and round and round in your head, and those of us that have been depressed know it. You can't stop it. And so one of the things is to get it out onto paper. And then I say, what I want you to do is I want you to journal for 20 minutes, probably about twice a day, depending on whether they're working and whether and how severe it is, but to get it out of their head. Then I want them to have some worry-free time. So go for a walk. If you can only walk around four streets around the houses, one of those blocks, if you can only do one of those, fine, do it. Day two, do two blocks. Day three, do three blocks, but every day get out and walk. It does amazing things to help. Great things, those endorphins. Then after you get back, probably haven't been able to do things, do a job. If you're studying, get that assignment rocking. If you're working or if you've got jobs to do, go clean the kitchen benches or dig the garden or whatever you need. Diet's also important. Minimum HI. HI being human interference. A banana has very little human interference. A meat pie has maximum human interference. I don't ask people to get all that chocolate out of their diet the first week, but start putting some good food in. Positive affirmations. Where negative things are going round and round, let's stop them. So together we write some little signs and they go home and they stick it either on the bathroom mirror or in their bedroom so that they begin to think positive thoughts. And then the other amazing thing is how many times do we call out to God, and, you know, we'll be singing or reading the Bible or something will come to us and we go, oh, yeah, that was really nice, and then we forget it. Let's write it down, let's stick it up on the mirror, and let's keep it happening. Treat yourself every day. Do something you used to enjoy. You mightn't enjoy it quite as much, but do it anyway. And then number 10, counselling. See your counsellor regularly. So this is a sheet that you'll have before you leave that gives us a start to depression. Now, you'll notice we haven't got into too much emotional baggage there. The first visit to the counsellor is pretty calm. No, it doesn't get any worse. And the counsellor will probably want to see the person a few times quite quickly so that we can really move things. And then it will probably ease out as the severity eases out. Now, what we do after that is we start looking at the baggage, this backpack of collected traumas, beliefs, horrible things, and we start sifting through it and we start throwing them out. We start changing the thoughts. And I've got a number of tools that I use. I use everything from recognised cognitive behaviour therapy through to some drawing therapy, through to some prayer stuff, all sorts of things I've got in my box of tricks that suits the person. You choose your doctor to suit you, you choose your counsellor to suit you, and I try and go with my patients. Particularly of concern to me are adolescents. I work most of my week with adolescents, and I'm seeing the amount of depression rising. And so, parents, it's really a good idea to keep a watch on your adolescents. And if you see their mood, their energy low, they're tired all the time, it could just be adolescence, but it's something that needs watching, because let's catch it early and let's save them years and years of collecting more and more baggage, because they're so low that every little hurt goes into the backpack. They've got no resilience, and that's another push in schools, is to give more resilience to students. Particularly girls will be excessively weepy, and the boys may get excessively angry. That's just a trend, it's not a rule, but that's what I notice as I work with them. I like the way Grant Mullen says that Christians experience depression worse, because that's what I find too. We get down and then we beat ourselves up. It's an illness that needs medical help, it needs counselling for the emotional, behavioural stuff, and it needs spiritual counselling, prayer ministry. The spiritual area needs addressing. So it's interesting that all three of us so far work on a very similar model. And Jane's nodding her head. She works with that model too. That we need to work in all these areas. If you're living with a person with depression, my heart goes out to you. Because I know that when I live with a person with depression, I would drive, in the front gate, and that black cloud would roll out to meet me. And it doesn't end, and they never cheer up, and they never say thank you. And it's hard work. And so that list of first aid is something that you might need to do for yourself. You need to look after yourself so that you can continue to look after them, because depression is incredibly draining for the carer. And you might need counselling to help you keep your spirits up, to help you not let the stress take you into depression. I love working with depression. I find it extremely responsive, extremely satisfying to work with, and it's one of the reasons that I still work in the two jobs, because it gives me the satisfaction of watching, first of all, getting the teenagers before they get into a pattern, and then I can deal with some really good depression and watch the fabulous results that can be got by a holistic model.
Jan Watt did prayer ministry training through Wholeness Through Christ Ministries in 1992. And she started ministering in the area of prayer ministry in 93. She ran a prayer ministry centre for 4 years before going overseas in 97 to do 9 weeks of School of Evangelism, Healing and Deliverance with LL Ministries in England, which some of you will have heard of. She ran the advanced course for Wholeness Through Christ for 2 years, as well as coordinating prayer ministry at her home church at Fountain Gate Christian Centre. Jan is currently the director of Sunrise School of Healing Ministries, having now nearly completed 5 years where students are trained, equipped and released people into the work of healing prayer ministry, and I'm one of those. These are people who have a heart to see others healed and set free. And Jan herself has a desire to know the presence of Jesus, and she also has a heart to preach the good news, heal the brokenhearted, and bring freedom and healing to those who are bound spiritually and emotionally and physically. Thanks, Jan.
Hi, it's lovely to be here with you tonight. And I do have a heart to see the captive set free. I believe anyone that's suffering from depression is truly a captive that needs to be set free. So, unfortunately, as Grant said before, Christians are not exempt from depression. wish we were, but we're not. Psalm 34, verse 18 says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and to those who are crushed in spirit." Now, that word brokenhearted actually means those whose lives have been shattered into pieces. It's like taking a glass of water and letting it drop on a concrete floor. What would happen to that glass? It would be literally shattered into pieces. Well, Jesus has come to heal the brokenhearted, to heal those whose lives have been shattered into pieces. And I believe that's good news, don't you? So as prayer ministers, we want to minister to the whole person. We want to minister to those whose lives have been shattered and broken. And we want to minister to the whole person, spirit, soul and body. You see, the real person is your spirit. Because once you die, it's your spirit and soul that's going to live on forever with the Lord. Your body returns to the dust of the earth. So the real you is your spirit. I can see your the clothes that you wear and I can see your body. But the real you is your human spirit. And you have a soul, which is your mind, your will and your emotions. And then, of course, we can see each other's physical bodies. And they're all interlinked. If something is happening in the body, obviously something's happening in the other. The body's only a third. Something's happening in the other two-thirds, in the soul and in the spirit. So when a person comes to me for prayer ministry, I rely on the Holy Spirit. I rely on the gifts of the Spirit. I rely on the word of wisdom. I rely on the word of knowledge. I rely on the gifts of healings and miracles. I rely on the gift of faith. I rely on the Holy Spirit, who is my leader, to show me, to lead me and guide me and direct me. After all, he is the healer. He is Jehovah Rapha, the Lord God who heals. So we like to consider how long the person has actually been in depression for when they come to us. We go through the symptoms checklist. I thought that was wonderful. I'd gone to see Grant in New Zealand at the beginning of last year, and then we had him over here. We were one of the sponsors. Sunrise was one of the sponsors when he came to speak at Crossways this year. And I printed off that checklist and I handed it out to my prayer ministry team. And I said, now we have to try and identify these symptoms when people come to us so that we know what is being presented. Because some people we refer to doctors, some people we refer to psychiatrists. We're not adverse to referring people on when we believe that we're out of our depth. So we want to consider how long the depression has been going on. And what has been going on in the life of the person prior to the depression, because that gives us a clue. Now, if we look at a person's life as a tree, and we look at what has happened in their lives as the roots of that tree, and if there's abuse in the root system of that tree, if there is a death of a loved one in the root system of that tree, if there is an accident or a trauma or anything like that in the root system of that tree, obviously growing on that tree, there's going to be good and bad fruit from what has happened in the root system, isn't there? Because the Bible tells us that no good tree can bear bad fruit, no bad tree can bear good fruit, or words to that effect. So we need to look at the root system. And we are good fruit inspectors. We want to find out, through the work of the Holy Spirit, what is happening in the person's life at the root level, so that they're not just band-aids aren't just put on and the fruit remains on the tree if it's bad fruit. We want the Holy Spirit to come and literally heal from the root up so that the bad fruit on the person's tree falls off and disappears and the person is healed and delivered and set free. So we also consider the person's emotions, because the spiritual element of emotional baggage is demonic influence. Whether we like to think that Christians can have demons or not, they can. I've seen them. I've delivered people with demons. And they like to hang on to emotional baggage. So we deal with the spiritual aspects of depression as well as the emotional aspects of depression. So a lot of us I think Christians in general suffer from depression have a hard time suffering from depression, but I really believe Christians in general have a hard time identifying their emotions. Really have a hard time identifying emotions of anger, identifying emotions of loss, identifying emotions of guilt and grief. And we help people in the school identify their emotions. So some of the things that we believe have led a person to depression in the emotional area are unresolved anger or frozen rage. So where there's anger for a long period of time and it's been unresolved and it's ongoing can lead to depression. You see, when we suppress our emotions, those emotions become buried alive. They don't become buried dead. They're actually buried alive emotions. So those emotions will reflect into the soul and they will reflect into the body, because a lot of our illnesses these days come from an emotional source. Guilt that has been prolonged, that's going on for a long time. And guilt, true guilt, comes from disobedience, and true guilt can come from a besetting sin that is an ongoing thing in our lives that we can't get free from. And that's true guilt. But we can also have perceived guilt, which is false guilt. So it can come, depression can come from a root of guilt as well. And a loss situation. If someone's still grieving, you know, 10 or 15 years later for a loved one or a loved animal, I've needed to deal with people that have been grieving for an animal for many, many, many years. That has been an aspect to the depression. But there is a time to grieve, isn't there? That it's not 10, 15, 20 years down the track. There is a time to grieve and a time to let go of that grief. But if someone is hanging on to that grief, there is demonic spirits that will attach to that, and it becomes a morbid grief, and that leads to depression. When a person has had a sense of injustice and unfairness in their life, think of a little child who's been sexually molested, sexually abused, or physically abused in some way. They don't know what to do with injustice as a little 4-year-old or a little 2-year-old. They don't know what to do with a sense of unfairness, so what does that little girl, little boy do? They just keep it inside, and it becomes buried alive. That emotion has to turn somewhere, and oftentimes it turns into depression. And also I've seen people that harbour unforgiveness in their heart and refuse to forgive. Forgiveness is a major key to any healing, whether it be physical, emotional or spiritual. Forgiveness is a major key. So when people harbour unforgiveness and they refuse to forgive and choose to forgive those that have harmed them or hurt them, that can also keep them in an attitude of depression. So when we are dealing with people that have emotional baggage and the symptoms are depression, we ask the Lord to take them back to the root memory, or to the memory where these symptoms, the anger or the grief or the injustice or the emotions are coming from. And in that memory, there may be lies attached. Often there's lies attached because all the negativity that's going around in the person's head, there's a lot of lies attached to that. And we're looking for the main lies. We're looking for inner vows. We're looking for judgments. We're looking for bitter root expectancies. We're looking for all those things. We're looking for any bitterness, any resentment, any unforgiveness that may have led the person to becoming depressed. We also cut ungodly soul ties. That might be new for some of you, but that's a major part of deliverance. As I said before, when we've had repressed emotions, there is a lot of demonic baggage that needs to be cast out as well. So we like Jesus to come and heal the roots so that we can just command the demonic to leave and there's no major manifestations. I think deliverance ministry over the years has got a bad name. We're not into delivering, delivering, delivering. We're into asking Jesus to come and heal at the roots so that the bad fruit in the person's life will drop off. But of course that means evicting demonic intruders. And we also take generational factors into account. It's like going to the doctor and they ask, you know, have your father or your mother had high blood pressure or diabetes and things like that. So we also take generational factors into account. We look for spiritual things that may have been passed down. For instance, a spirit of infirmity, a spirit of depression. I'd like to think that it was as simple as that. It's not as simple as that. We usually act on words of knowledge so that... But we're looking for spirits of infirmity. We're looking for things that have spiritually been transferred down through the family line. And, you know, a friend of mine was suffering deep depression last year. And in her case, it was medication, it was prayer ministry, and a lot of love and support by family members that really saw her through. So her whole person was being ministered to. It wasn't just one aspect of her. The whole three parts of her had to be treated. And we saw a major breakthrough when she contacted someone that she had withdrawn from about 4 or 5 years previously. And when she made contact with that person and they had a chat on the phone, she rang me up and she cried like a little baby. And I said, that's okay, just let it go, just let it go. You see, all that pent-up grief, all that rejection, all that anxiety that hadn't been given an expression 4 or 5 years previous had all built up. And that was a key to her release as well as the medication. Amen. Thank you.
We're going to open it up to you to come with your questions. If you have a particular question, can you raise your hand?
What's ECT?
Shock therapy.
Cool.
I just found out just a couple of days ago that in the early 1800s, one of my relations was a Mason. Now, does Masonry have a lot to do with depression? I've heard that. Can you just clarify that?
Well, Masonry is steeped in occult and witchcraft roots. It's a pagan religion, and it can lead to all sorts of sicknesses, infirmities, illnesses, including depression, but you'd have to have a word of knowledge from the Lord, really, if that was the way to go, because depression has many facets that could be an aspect to having depression. But certainly have prayer ministry into the area of Freemasonry, because there's a lot of things hang on to Freemasonry, a lot of things, a lot of deliverance needed, and if someone's in a Freemason, they'll need to come out of the Freemasonry Lodge. They'll need to burn all the regalia and get rid of everything and ask for their name to be actually erased from the Freemasonry register. Okay.
Bev, I was going to make the comment about ECT. I was working in a private psychiatric hospital for 3 months where they practiced it twice a week. And... It has a lot of connotations of Frankenstein, which is totally incorrect. What they generally do is they give you a sedative and put you into quite a deep sort of sleep, and then it's administered. And each person gets their own individual level of dosage. The guy that was actually a practitioner of it was a very good evangelical Anglican and took me through the whole process of what he does in his little clinic. And they're very strictly supervised as well. Most people who are in very deep depression actually look forward to it because it's like resetting the button on your computer. It's really the only thing that works, and that's what they go to as a last resort. So if any of you get into a very, very deep depression, you won't be really weighing up a lot of the issues. You'll be desperate for something that works, and it is actually something that works quite well with certain sorts of depression.
Thanks very much for that, Rob.
It's a question for Len.
If someone is on permanent medication for depression and they are going along fine, and then something triggers a depressive relapse, does that mean that their medication should be changed, or is that, what's the case there?
It depends what caused it. You know, if they're going along fine, what does that mean? Are they having counselling as well? Because often a relapse will be they've hit another major life something and they don't deal with it particularly well. Sometimes the medication needs changing, but if they've been on it for a long time and they've been stable, it's probably not the medication. They probably need counselling or something else. But occasionally they do.
Ruth, I work with the youth here at this church, and I'm wondering if you could give me and any youth leaders advice on, I guess, identifying youth with depression or symptoms of depression, and maybe how to help them or how to come alongside them in that state.
There we go. I get to sit down. Okay, you're looking... When you came in, you should have got a checklist. You're looking for depressed mood, low mood persistently. You're looking for low energy, poor sleeping patterns is often a giveaway. And the other fun one to ask them is go, are you thirsty often? Because serotonin's also tied up with saliva. Am I correct? Yeah, I researched that one and I'm watching it. And it's a fun one to ask because sometimes it's hard to pick a downer from depression. Depression is a time thing, so it has to be for... Ask them how long they've been feeling like that and then say, why don't you get your doctor to check it out? Working in a school, I often say to students, I'd really like your doctor to check this out. And it makes them think about it and what they want to do. And as I am a counsellor, I can deal with that bit. And it's a good thing to talk to their parents and say, I'm wondering if, because most parents do like to be involved, and I'm wondering if you might take them to the doctor and have this checked out against a checklist, or here's a checklist, why don't you look at it and see what you think?
Thanks. This sort of follows on from that, but... With sort of young people, in terms of cost of counselling and stuff, are there services that are available for people that can't afford to pay?
There's good news on this front because as of today, the government is actually subsidising psychology services through your doctor. So now you can actually get... subsidised psychology, and it's substantial subsidy too, so it's good psychology.
It's about six sessions.
Yeah, but they need to get more.
There's other services around. Your local community health centre often has really good counsellors. They're not Christian, but I found they work really well with Christian students, and they're free. Yes. At Carinya, we have a $15 student clinic where the students are doing the work. They're almost qualified, and so that's a lot cheaper. And anyone that can't afford it at a place like Carinya, talk to us. All right? I like to eat too, but I'm sure we can come to an agreement. All right?
I'm doing counselling in our church, and... This lady who comes quite often and see her every Friday anyway, but she's always doped up, like high on drugs. But she's not drugs, but because of her depression, she's taking this medication and we cannot get a breakthrough there. So I just want to know, can we coordinate with the doctor to recheck her medication and all that? Or how do we go about doing that one?
She said the word medication. You would have to go through her to ask that. You'd have to ask her whether it was appropriate to speak to her doctor, and if she thought it was okay, then I see no reason why you shouldn't talk to her doctor about her medication. But it would have to go through her. I don't know that you could just ring up and behind her back and ask. Have you asked her what medication she's actually on? And that's probably why she's not making much progress. But, yeah, ask her if she would be happy for you to talk to her doctor.
I'd like to ask, people who suffer from depression often experience a lack of connectedness with their community, often as a secondary effect. How can the church community address this or be aware of this?
I think the church can have a really big impact. Grant Mullen, on one of his other tapes, talks about how the depressed person is removed from the spiritual community because they're feeling really down. They go along to church and somebody says, "And how are you?" Worst thing you ever want to hear. And so we can set up a way of dealing with people that are depressed and reconnect with them. And so just saying something different like, "Would you like a cup of tea?" makes such a difference to drawing that person in. Not making any condemnation makes such a difference. I've heard some dreadful things said in love, but let's treat them very gently and just draw them in and accept them where they're at and take them walking, you know, get them doing something with you so that it's not all talk because their brain's not connected.
And offer practical assistance. If they've got young children, offer to take them to school or kinder, you know, offer to make them a meal. Have a roster so that they don't have to make any meals themselves. They can't think to do anything. They, you know, they're indecisive. The person I was talking about couldn't get out of bed. She was suicidal and she had three young children. So we had to do practical things for her. We had to care practically to her. And that spoke volumes to her later when she recovered. That spoke volumes, the family support that she had, the care that she had, her husband's care. Once the children, she had to explain, they had to explain to the children what was happening. And once the children knew, the children were 5, 10 and 13 at that stage, they all rallied in. But she had meals made, she had washing done, she had ironing done, so she didn't have to think about the practicalities of day-to-day living, which took a lot of the pressure off.
I think too, it's the individual response to that person too that is so critical. As a huge community of people, you can imagine someone walking in through the doors finds that incredibly overwhelming. But also, if they're confused in their mind, there's no way they're going to be able to concentrate on a 20-minute-plus sermon, or they're not going to be able to, you know, enter into a prayer time as well as the normal person who's functioning well. So I think it's being able to come alongside someone individually and to pray with them, short prayers, to be able to talk to them about, you know, things that are important, is very supportive and caring.
And you know, they can't listen to praise tapes or anything like that, but if you put those sorts of tapes on in the background, they won't make an effort to do that because they physically can't do it. But if you make an effort to sit and read the word to them and put praise tapes on in the background, it does make a difference.
Jan?
Yes, Bill.
Where does one go to find prayer ministry, and how do you work out whether it's the right place to go?
Okay, well, there's a list of prayer ministry centres in and around Melbourne, in Ballarat and Geelong, on the table. So make sure you get a list of those prayer ministry centres. So you can go to any one of those centres. One of those centres is here in this church, isn't it, Bev? Just beginning. So have a look on that list, the orange list out the back. And what was the other part of the question, Bill?
The second part of the question was how do you know that those people who are working in those centres are qualified, I suppose, trained to do the work?
Yeah, well, we've all been trained in different through different means, whether it's been Wholeness Through Christ, Sunrise Training, Elijah House. There is a criteria for being accepted onto the prayer ministry teams. We don't just accept anyone. So you need to have completed one of those courses to be actually on one of those prayer ministry teams. So you can usually guarantee that, you know, they have a heart to see people healed and set free.
As Jan said, we are at St Alfred's just starting prayer ministry, and it's been a little bit more behind the scenes. So if someone comes to me, you know, as the pastoral care worker and says, look, I think I really need prayer ministry, I'll often say, go and pray about who you would like, whether or not you want it to be here at St Alfred's or you want it to be outside. And I've been surprised, actually, at the number of people who are happy to have it in-house, so to speak. And it seems to be that God, by His Holy Spirit, is just gently bringing people along our way. And at the moment, we have a small team and we're growing that. But again, we want to fulfil some of that criteria that we all understand the confidentiality, we all understand the basics of prayer ministry before we embark on it.
I think it's really good that every person has a carer, support team, whatever you want to call it, who are sensitive to where the person's at and doesn't jolly them along too much, because depressed people don't like to be jollied. Often you can't connect with them a lot, and doing things for them is the biggest help. But then when they want to talk, just listening, and listening some more, and then encouraging them to get the medical, the spiritual, and the counselling help, so that they move through it faster. I think the more people supporting each other, often the people need to support each other rather than the depressed person. We're talking fairly severe depression there. Let's stepping back to milder depression. Often they only relate to a couple of people, and they can often still do some stuff but not others. Like the supermarket is big, but they might be able to actually make a simple meal. So there's levels of depression, and I think levels of what people need.
I'd like to ask a question to Jan, if I may. Jan, what are the signs and indicators whereby you can tell the difference between a severely depressed person who is possessed or oppressed by a spirit of depression, and on the other hand, a severely depressed person who is not?
I guess there's a fine line between what is demonic and what isn't demonic. With my understanding is of a severely depressed person, there is a chemical imbalance that needs to be treated. And we've seen some people that have come for prayer ministry prior to us having the checklist, where we have tried to cast out demons and things like that. With the knowledge that we now have, we've identified that that was the wrong thing to do because of the checklist and the symptoms. We now say, well, we refer you to the doctor to be put on medication. Then when your thoughts and so forth, and you can concentrate, when that comes back into balance, come back and we'll deal with the spiritual and we'll deal with the emotional aspects. But a lot of people don't come back because they get on the medication and they think everything, they do, don't they? And they think everything's solved. But it doesn't always work. But you need a word of knowledge, specific word of knowledge, to cast out any spirit of depression. Yes, I have. But I haven't gone for like a spirit of depression first off. What we've done is treated the emotional baggage that have produced the symptom of depression, and then commanded the demons to leave. And there's usually a demon of confusion, a demon of depression, demon of grief, and a few other demons. There's a family of them, if you know what I mean, attached to that, depending on what has been at the roots. If there's grief, there'll be a demon of morbid grief in there. If there's loss and if there's injustice, there'll be things equivalent to that. in there as well. But we want Jesus to do the healing first before we command any demons to leave. The demons have to go when the emotional baggage has been healed because they've got no legal rights to stay there anymore.
Lynn, over here. I think it was you that made the comment about the relationship between depression and anxiety and being interlinked. We've spoken about depression. We haven't spoken a lot about anxiety. Would you be able to open that up? Maybe not so much from a, perhaps from a medical point of view, but also if any of you can talk about it, just identifying what anxiety. The anxiety side of it is.
How do you do? Yeah. There's usually... They do go hand in hand. So if somebody has a lot of anxiety symptoms, I'm thinking panic type, we think specifically panic attacks, so people are sort of bound by their anxiety. It might be social phobias, so when they're with people they get particularly anxious. Obsessive compulsive disorder where they have compulsions that are designed really to reduce their anxiety. That's what the compulsions do. Those people, it's a chronic illness as well, so they become depressed. But they're both mediated by the same chemicals in the brain. So there's usually a bit of both. Is that...
Are there any real differences between postnatal depression and normal,
normal depression?
Other sorts of depression?
I don't believe so. It's a phase of life depression and the symptoms are all the same. It just happens to somebody who's just had a baby and there all the connotations around that. Well, I think it's hormonal, but there are people who dispute that too.
This question is probably to Ruth and Jan. You're halfway along the counselling prayer process and you've accessed a lot of this emotional baggage. And you mentioned the comment that Christians have a hard time identifying emotions. How do you help the people get to those last grotty, nitty-gritty bits that, you know, just are hiding and lurking and they can't get them out?
We have ways and means of helping them, gentle and compassionate ways and means of helping them. Sometimes it's as simple as saying, does your heart have a voice? When you were four, was you, you know, did your heart have a voice then? And they might say yes. Well, your heart still has that voice. You think we can access that voice? Would you be able to give your heart permission to speak now? And that's a very, very gentle tool, but it's a very powerful tool to use. Just giving the person permission to speak. If they've been abused, if there's been any sense of injustice in their lives, they've often lost their voice and have no way of expressing themselves, and that voice has been buried alive. So just giving them permission to speak, permission to release their emotions is very, very healing to them. Might be the first time in their life that they've ever thought they have permission to release their emotions. And we see a lot of Christians that have buried a lot of anger and have unresolved anger because they believe that Christians shouldn't have anger. Well, it does. Well, God's an angry God. Jesus got angry. You know, our God's an emotional God. He has a whole gambit of emotions, good and bad. And so just the very fact that you give people permission to be angry and permission to express themselves is very, very healing in itself.
On my wall, I have a poster. The poster has a whole lot of faces with different expressions and a word underneath. And often for the men, we have to go through the poster. But then we've got some other gentle ways of getting to what's underneath. I mean, that's what we're skilled in, is peeling the onion back and finding out what's at the core of it, which is why we can't solve it in one go.
Have any of you come across a child as young as 7 with depression? And if so, what have you done about it?
Primary school, yes. In fact, I'm finding it more and more in upper primary school. The early signs. Sometimes we have to wait until they get a bit older And I say to Mum, can you see this through the years? Can you see what's happening here? Can you see the pattern? Medication's not usual at that age. Some of the fun stuff I do can help release what is holding them in that thought pattern or that belief. Because, I mean, a lot of our beliefs are formed by the time we're two. Is life safe? Are men safe? Are women safe? Am I important? They're all decided before we even talk. And so it sometimes shows up in primary school. And I use a Christian counselling method as well as the correct traditional ones. And it's a little bit like Jan's, in that it takes them to Jesus and we sit there and we draw and fun things like that. So we have fun and we teach them that, you know, being with Jesus is a life-giving experience.
I'll just ask you, do you think that it's becoming more frequent because puberty's getting a little younger? So the late primary school, a lot of those kids are actually going through puberty. Do you think that has a bearing on it as a major hormonal kind of change and being so young and having to face all that?
I've got a lot of factors I think might be involved, from the stresses that kids are under because of changes in parenting. I'm noticing the pendulum has swung back on parenting and there's a lot of under-parented kids. Then I wonder about hormones in meat.
Jan, just before you said God has a range of emotions, good and bad. Knowing you for many years, I think that's a typo of the lips. Perhaps you could reword it.
Oh, well, he's an emotional God, isn't he? He gets angry. He rejoices over us. He dances over us, you know. I'm sure that he's grieved over injustice. I'm sure, you know, things that are happening in the world today grieve him. So I meant negative emotions, not bad emotions.
Can I actually have the last word on emotions? I usually tell people that emotions are signposts. They're not good or bad, they just are. And they tell you something about you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, the three of you. I just want to conclude with a verse from 1 Thessalonians. But just prior to that, I want you to just focus now on Jesus, because he is the healer. Jesus came to release us from the power of sin. He also wants to set us free from the captivity of our minds. May God bless and empower your walk, my walk, to freedom. And from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 23 to 24. May God himself, the God of peace, sanctify you through and through. May your whole spirit, soul and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. The one who calls you is faithful and he will do it. Amen.